Hi, this is Chris from PleasureMechanics.com. Welcome to the Speaking of Sex podcast. On today's episode, we have a very special guest, Karen Duffy. You might remember her as Duff from MTV, The Glory Days, when she was the coolest girl on TV, and definitely one of my role models with her tomboyish charm and awesome attitude. She was so much fun, and she still is. She's a rock star. Her life took a twist when, during her height as an MTV VJ and as a Revlon model and film actor, she started getting sick and was diagnosed with sarcoidosis, which is a disease that causes the growth of inflammatory cells called granulomas in her brain and central nervous system. This has ravaged her health, and she is now living with a chronic illness and chronic pain. But in her true Duff style, she has transformed this experience into a generous sharing of her lived experience as a mother, as a wife, as a writer in her two books, the New York Times bestseller Model Patient and her new book Backbone, Living with Chronic Pain Without Turning into One. It is a book full of humor and wisdom and storytelling about what it's like to live with chronic pain. And of course, I resonated with this after my own recent health crisis and learning how to live well with chronic pain. And so I reached out to Karen Duffy and asked her if she would be willing to come on the podcast and talk about some things that aren't in her book, talk about the more intimate side of living with chronic pain and how she is able to maintain intimacy and pleasure while her body is dealing with chronic, intense pain. And she generously said yes, she was willing to talk to us about these intimate matters. And so this interview is my conversation with Karen Duffy. And again, I'm going to drop you right into the conversation. Often when I am doing an interview, I start chatting with the person before kind of a formal interview starts. And sometimes we just dive right into this beautiful, honest conversation. And I don't want to cut that part out for you. And so here is my conversation with Karen Duffy about chronic pain, living well, and finding pleasure in spite of all of the unexpected obstacles that life can bring us. Before we start the interview, I want to remind you that you can find the complete podcast archive at pleasuremechanics.com, where you will also find the opportunity to sign up for the Erotic Essentials, our free online course that offers you a treasure trove of resources so you can start building the foundation of a happy, exciting sex life. And when you are ready, check out our online mastery courses so you can level up your skills in things like couples massage, foreplay, butt play, erotic spanking, kinky sex, whatever adventure you are ready to go on next. And when you do, use the code SPEAKINGOFSEX for 20% off your online course. Okay, here is my conversation with Karen Duffy.
Great, thank you. Well, I checked out your other podcasts and I've downloaded your course, and I just want to say thank you so much for doing this. I love the fact that you are Pleasure Mechanics, because, you know, with people who live with chronic pain, invisible illness, disability, it doesn't mean that you're too broken to be in a relationship, in a sexual relationship. But what I've witnessed and also experienced in my own life is a true sense of shame. There's a lot of shame in having chronic pain and having a chronic illness. And I think that does impede one's sexual life.
Yeah, and I'm coming to this, you know, as a sex educator for 10 years and then got really ill about a year and a half ago. And I was sick for 9 months and then almost died, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes that had gone undiagnosed, and a whole host of other autoimmune conditions. And I'm now healing from that, but will be living with chronic pain for the rest of my life. And so it feels like a whole reality shift.
It is. Well, I'm sorry. How are you feeling now,
I'm
Chris?
okay. I'm okay. Yeah. You know, I have a lot of neuropathy.
Yes, I shared that with you.
Yeah. And as you say, this invisible pain. And so sometimes my partner or a friend will look at me and they don't see anything's wrong, but there's this thunderstorm of pain going through my body and I'm just trying to ride that through.
I know. It's well, the hard thing about chronic pain is that, again, it is invisible, and your partners, your coworkers, your family, people who love you, they cannot bear witness to it. But the other thing is that chronic pain, it actually destroys language. When you are in pain, you're like, ah! It's impossible to verbalize because we are stricken, and other than moaning, I just find it's interesting that when we have joyful experiences or cataclysmic experiences, or we have great poets and writers to express those emotions and passions for us. But when you try to describe pain, it is just language runs dry. And I think the inexpressibility is another disabling and isolating factor of chronic pain, is that it's very hard to express and explain.
So how do you manage this with your husband day to day? How do you communicate kind of where your body's at and what you're up for?
Well, it's interesting. So I eloped with my husband at probably my worst. I met my husband in my acute phase, and I was so ill that we just decided, let's just elope. I mean, the world's kind of, who knows what's going to happen. So my husband has never known me. He didn't know the old me. Wow. He knows this version. So in a way, Chris, I've had to kind of mourn for my old life and then figure out who I am in this new life. And with my husband, it's interesting because I tend to not talk a lot about my illness or my level of pain, because I like to spare him, and he travels a lot. But one of the tough things is when you have neuropathy, and I have something called, anytime I say a Latin or French word, I'll sound like Gomez Adams, but it's allodynia. And that is the sensation where you feel pain when a feather would feel like a blowtorch, or air or wind. So, my husband talks about my body's almost like a twister board. Like, there are certain places, dots that just can't be touched. And for me, I have a lesion in my brain from my C7 up to my medulla, and it's the whole area of my shoulder, probably my right breast up, all the way up to above my ear. It just feels like I've got this big, heavy, angry African gray parrot, and he's got his scaly claws in my shoulder, and then he's pecking with this razor beak up around my head and neck. So that is probably the most vexing part of the pain map of my body. But as you know, it also travels. And when I wake up in the morning, it's kind of like in The Wizard of Oz, when those mean monkeys go flying and then pull all the hay out of the scarecrow. So when I wake up in the morning, I have to take inventory and see, all right, like, can I feel my feet? Can I feel my hands? Like, How am I doing? And I don't know about you, Chris. Is there a time of day where it's more difficult for you to kind of get going, or is there a time when you feel more pain?
Morning and night.
Yeah, me too. I think in the morning, because we need to take our pain medicines again in the morning. So I usually have an hour of quiet time. So I'll get up, you know, 5 and take the medication, and it needs about an hour to kind of get through my system. And then by then I can put clothes on and start, you know, getting my family ready for the day, make breakfast, the whole works. And then early evening, when the pain kind of matriculates, I definitely need a little bit of quiet time to rejigger and recalibrate. And usually that's when most, you know, my husband and kid are out of the house. And, you know, I was thinking about the term invisible illness, and how our pain is invisible. What plagues us is invisible, but I become invisible on really bad days. Like, you know, when the pain is, you know, jacked up, then I somewhat retreat. So I think there's kind of a duality of the invisibility of illness.
Yeah. Can you take us back to the beginning? So the first line of your book is, there is pain that hurts you and pain that changes you, which is a line that's really stuck with me. Can you just introduce yourself, how people might know you, and how your life changed with pain?
Mm-hmm. My name is Karen Duffy, and I probably most well known from being a VJ during the Jurassic age of VJs on MTV in the early 90s.
You were one of my heroes. You were the coolest girl on TV. For sure.
It was, so, you know, it was amazing, Chris, because before I was a VJ, I have a BS in recreational therapy. I went on to Cal Berkeley for postgrad, and I am a recreational therapist, emeritus now. So the profession that I felt truly called to do was working with special populations, specifically severely and profoundly disabled populations. I just felt like I don't scare easy, and I love the one-to-one contact of working in a group home or working in a nursing home, and it was truly my favorite thing. So I was living in New York City, where I'm from, and I was working at the Village Nursing Home. My job was to call bingo and host the Frank Sinatra Appreciation Society. The whole idea of recreational therapy is to focus on ability and focus on what you can do rather than what you cannot. And most of the populations that I was serving had Alzheimer's or dementia. And so I became skillful in how to have my population that had a very short attention span, how to get them to pay attention to me during bingo games or during our class. And I realized that, you know, everyone's saying that MTV is shortening the attention spans of the youth. And I was like, so I'm working with this elderly population. So I serendipitously made a unsolicited videotape of myself pretending to be a VJ, walking around the city, and sent it into MTV. And I had this overnight metamorphosis where I was, you know, in frowsy substitute teacher separates calling bingo on a Monday. And then Tuesday, I had the Aladdin's cave of the MTV wardrobe closet, and literally went from calling bingo to announcing videos.
Wow.
Right. And so that was kind of cool. And I felt like I snuck into a party and I was just waiting to get kicked out. So I had a lot of fun. And I was there for about 4 years. And it was great because it was the transition from heavy metal, big hair bands to the dawn of the grunge era. And it was right leading into like Britney Spears and the boy bands and Justin Timberlake. And so in a relatively half a decade, I was bearing witness to three very different genres of music and pop culture. And so while I was kind of on this Nantucket sleigh ride of working as a VJ, and I was the Charlie girl for Revlon, and started doing films, I kept having these weird bouts of pneumonia that would just knock me out, and several a year. And then I would just have, you know, and I'm a very healthy, chronically ill person. And I was feeling pain, and I just kept pushing through until there's a critical moment when you can't push through and you're like, ah, I've got to go to the hospital. And so I, again, like in one night, I had a second metamorphosis where I went from lavishly healthy to then chronically and treatably, but incurably sick. And so that changed every aspect of my life. And I was, you know, running around dating a lot of knuckleheads and having a lot of fun. And I wound up eloping with my husband, John, and who was my roommate in a beach house. And he was just amazing. I was going through chemotherapy treatment. And so during the week, I would get the injection and I tolerated it really well. And then a few days later is when you get grievously unwell. And he just saw me like laying on the cool tiles of the bathroom of our scrappy, it was the only bathroom we had in this scrappy beach shack. And he hated to see me on that scrappy floor. So he bought me a dog bed from L.L. Bean and had my name on it. And I was like, okay, that may be, who knew that a dog bed could be one of the sexiest, most romantic gifts. it's funny. What I was thinking about is like, often beauty is a byproduct of just something ordinary. Like he saw a need that I should probably not be laying on that sandy bathroom floor and bought me a dog bed. And I was like, all right, if that guy can be so compassionate, then I think hitching a ride, we would have a lot of fun together. And I love the fact that my husband was not afraid to, you know, be with a partner who has a chronic illness. And he did not have fear. And, you know, what we talked earlier about was the shame. And I don't know if you've had that feeling, but it can be really embarrassing. In the beginning, like, I was on steroids and I grew a mustache and, you know, lost a lot of my hair and had a hunchback and all these weird things that happened from side effects of medicine. And at some point I was just like, you know, I'm just going to stop being embarrassed. And I will only allow myself to feel shame if I'm a complete jackass. If I'm mean or unkind or do something really stupid, then I will prostrate myself and apologize. But other than that, I will completely disassociate myself and shed embarrassment and just focus on acceptance.
Wow.
And so far that's been working.
And do you think that shame was heightened because you came from this world of being a public persona, being a model, where your body was so central to your identity? And then did you feel a sense of betrayal
from your body? That's an interesting question, Chris, because I really, as a model, I felt like I was a fraud. I felt like a Leroy Neiman in a gallery of Van Goghs. I mean, I would, when I would do a photo shoot with Cindy Crawford and Frederik van der Waal, I mean, I didn't look like the same species as those girls. Like, so I was, I've always felt like, and it was great because I did work for Revlon for, probably 15 years. And I was only probably healthy for about 2 of those years. Wow. So eventually I had to, my agent, and we had to tell Revlon, listen, the person that you hired, that ship has sailed. Mm-hmm. Like, I am not going to be that like sassy Charlie girl. No. And it was amazing. Revlon, which is a company that, focuses on women's looks and the exterior. But what I really appreciate about them as a company is that they really care about women's health. And they've raised over $200 million for women's healthcare research and the breast cancer the first non-toxic breast cancer treatment, tamoxifen, was absolutely a direct result from the hundreds of thousands, millions of women who would come out for the past 15 years to do the Revlon Run Walk. Wow. So I appreciate that. But I really felt like my thing was I was more of a wise ass, and I feel more connected to my spirit than my corpus. And I think the shame I was feeling was I have so much more to do. And if I'm going to be in this meat cage that is just so painful that I can't wear clothes or turn my head or hold a pencil, that's going to be tricky.
Yeah.
And I was embarrassed because I didn't want my parents or my family to worry or my friends, and then I've got this new partner and I don't want to worry him. So I think that's where the shame really came from. I felt like I didn't want to magnify so much attention on my illness and destabilize our relationship and have the illness be a looming extra presence in my life. I wanted, it's funny because, when you're well, like, I just remember like when I was like vibrantly healthy and unconscious of how healthy I was, but like, I was always thinking like, oh, I'm going to try and like, I was amazing at getting out of work. Like, my agent bought me, this medical textbook, and we would pretend that I had all these ailments and I would malinger to get off of work. And then when you're actually sick, all you want to do is work.
Yeah.
It's funny how that levels out.
So a lot of your work has become writing these books about your journey and sharing your experience of chronic illness and chronic pain. Why is that important to you, or what is your intention in sharing your story?
My intention in sharing the story of my first book, Model Patient, was really about the acute phase of illness, and that is the early part. This new book, Backbone, is about the chronic. And chronic comes from the Greek chronos, meaning time. And so essentially, and the word pain comes from the Latin quona, meaning punishment or penalty. So chronic pain, when you kind of put those root words together, is essentially you're serving a life sentence for a crime that you didn't commit.
Yeah.
And I felt that, listen, if I'm living with multiple chronic conditions, I am going to milk this for everything it's worth and use the you know, I'm uninsurable, so I can't work in front of a camera. I can't work for a corporation because I can't pass the physical. And the doctor cannot guarantee that if I show up for work one day and it's a multi-million dollar project, that I will be well enough to see it through. Yeah. So I had to, I mean, I was always writing, went on MTV, you know, I wrote my scripts and I've worked with Michael Moore and wrote, pieces, and we all, you know, worked writing jokes. And, I just felt like every day we have a choice, and that is we can be useful or useless. And I thought, if I can use my voice in the fact that share the story of what it's like to live with chronic pain, but tell it in a way that it is not painful to read. Yeah. And then if I sell any books, then how great that I can then donate that to a 501(c) charity that only focuses on research. So I figured, well, that's a good motivator. And maybe I'll be able to be a little more useful.
And you bring so much humor and compassion to this topic, which is so refreshing. And you also talk about like being in the hospital, how you'd play little gags on the hospital staff. What role has humor played in coping with this illness?
Well, it's funny. One of my favorite quotes is from Lord Byron, who said, "Always laugh when you can, because it's cheap medicine." He wrote that 250 years ago. I think there is so much gallows humor when you have an illness. And I think the big part of my partnership with my husband is the fact that we can pretty much laugh at anything. And as my body's changing, and it's amazing because chronic illness can age you in presidential years. Like, you think you're holding up pretty good, and then you turn around, you're like, "Ooh, I'm covered. I'm just one giant liver spot." Like, it's like, what the hell's happening? And the fact that my husband and I can laugh. I mean, I'm not as graceful as I once was, and so I've broke 3 feet in 1 year. I broke my left foot right through there. At one point, I had I had a walking cast on each foot. But he was great. Like, he helped me spray paint them, so I had them gold for a while, and I had silver ones. And I, I like that. I try, maybe a sense of humor is trying to console myself, but also console my friends that, and the people that I love, like trying to, maybe it's almost, was it the formula for humor is pain plus time equals humor. I think that's what, Woody Allen said. And I like that, I feel like in a way, a lot of humor is obfuscating and covering up pain and, the basis of good humor. And I don't want to scare people. So I'd rather than scaring them, I think I'd try and cheer them up.
Yeah. And so how do you navigate this in your relationship with your husband? And how old is your son now?
He's 14.
Okay. And so raising a child, like, how can you both be realistic about what we're capable of, but then also show up fully for the people we love? Like, how did you find that balance about being authentic about your limitations while also striving to take care of the people you love and show up for your life?
You know, I think that, you know, you said that really beautifully. Like, you, I do want to show up and be an active partner. It's always vacillating. Like, there are days when I'm quite mobile and I want to, you know, just absolutely, you know, squeeze as much life as I can out of these great days. And then there are days where I am not as mobile and roped to my sofa like Gulliver, but I'm still going to squeeze as much fun as I can out of those days, because I do feel so grateful, and I'm deeply grateful for my family, for my having a partner that is just so cool and so courageous. He wasn't afraid of having to deal with someone who has a degenerative nerve condition.
Yeah,
and you know, my kid's like, he's like, Mom, I don't know you any other way. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what you're, when I asked him, like, is it, you know, are you, what's it like? Because I'm going to, I said, you know, with, when I'm going to tell this story of our life in this book, I want, you know, there's where people are going to ask, like, what's it like, you know, being a kid whose mom, you know, can't tie her shoes, or, you know, can't use her hands as well, and, you know, has vision issues. And he's like, yeah, it's no big deal. And my kid's like, yeah, everybody has something. Nobody's perfect. And I thought that was so wise, very wise.
There's moments where I feel like guilty for what I can't do with my daughter. And then I realize that I can just transform that into showing up as fully as I can. And that because it's a conscious effort, it's actually much more meaningful than if I was just going through life without thinking about these things. You know, it's like, I think you call it extra innings in the book. There's a sense
yes.
of life is so precious when you have to live it deliberately every day.
That's so beautifully said. And, you know, for everything we have lost, I feel like we have gained something else. And what we may have gained may just maybe patience or forgiveness to forgive ourselves.
Yeah.
I feel like so much about life is doing what you love and doing a lot of it. It was interesting to, we're talking and we are near on the day that is very near to the anniversary of Sandy Hook massacre. And last night I went to the Sandy Hook promise, and Vice President Joe Biden gave an amazing speech. Oh, sorry. Thanks. And he said that in order to find your purpose, you need to find someone to love, something to do, and something to look forward to. And I just found that, like, indelible, that what a man who has had multiple tragedies and endured difficult illness and cancer and trauma. And I just loved his recipe for finding your purpose, finding someone to love, something to do, and something to look forward to. I really felt enveloped by that.
So what is your relationship to pleasure? Chronic pain can be so overwhelming that it almost feels like there's not room in our bodies for pleasure. How do you relate to physical pleasure, sensual pleasure, sexual pleasure? How do you make space for that in your life?
You know, it's such a great question, Chris, because, again, there is, I would say, in the rookie phase of my illness, I felt that I was too broken to even think about a sexual relationship. And I was in, I had a monogamous relationship. And I was just like, well, you know, I went and spoke to a psychotherapist who studies the psychology of illness in women. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like I need to talk about libido, because when you have chronic illness, it's interesting. I didn't go on a cruise ship, but last week I wound up having the cruise ship virus, that norovirus, which, oh my gosh, you're seasick and on the poop deck for no reason. I was so violently ill. But it was amazing that when I was talking to my doctor, I was like, when I was so sick on that bathroom floor, I said, that was probably the only time in 19 years where I was not aware of the chronic burning sensation in my neck from the nerve pain. Ugh. And my doctor explained, well, when your body can really only handle so much information, and whatever is dominant will kind of rule your body. And that when you're so sick with this virus, it distracted you from your neuropathic pain. And so I was talking to Dr. Auchincloss, and I was like, well, how can we work with making sexual desire become dominant over chronic pain when I want to have an intimate and really satisfying relationship? And the sad part is that I'm losing feeling all over my body. And one of, I think I'm always looking for the upside when your life turns upside down. And one of the great things you realize is that sexual desire and sexual pleasure, as we know, is the biggest sexual organ we have is our brain. And so visual stimulation is great. And a big issue in my relationship is I have to wear these patches, it's like the size of a slice of Sicilian pizza. So it's this big, about like the size of a half sheet of paper. Uh-huh. And I have to wear that on right above my breast. Where really the nerves are the most dangerous to be touched. And, you know, just having that, like I will, like a lot of times, like, you know, my husband knows he can't touch me there, or my kid. Like when my son was a baby and I'd only hold him on the right side, and he figured out that I only held them on the left side. My right side is damaged. And he was always like, I'm going to touch your neck. Like he would pretend. And I think my husband's analogy of that, my body is like a twister board. Mm-hmm. So right shoulder, you know, right breast, no. And the biggest thing about having a great sex life while you're living with a chronic illness is to focus on, okay, how are you going to do it? And also don't diminish your sex life. And when I worked at the nursing home, and what I really loved was that this nursing home in New York City, as a recreational therapist, part of my job was to get, I would say, soft porn for the elderly men at night. The security guard would show these guys, you know, they'd watch movies, you know, and these are people in wheelchairs. And I thought, you know, that's really cool and progressive, and never knew that they would be teachers for me. You know, I talk a lot. I love a book. It's called Intoxicated by My Illness. It's by Anatole Briard. And his thesis is we should find a style for your illness. Figure out how you're going to be ill. And like right now, when I was going to talk to you and, you know, we're on a podcast, I put on a dress and I put on lipstick because I want to, you know, that's who I want to, I am and who I present to the world. And that is the style into which I'm going to be sick. And I also want to, as a middle-aged woman, like, not fall into this cliche of, I'm closed up, like, you know, I'm out of business. I've had, like, girlfriends tell me, yeah, you know, sex, forget it, I'm out of business. And I'm like, dude, there's nothing wrong with you. I'm so covetous. Like, how can you choose to just be out of business? And I think you can go through a dry spell. And the great thing about dry spells is that, you know, we can always irrigate. And
make it rain.
You know, and focus and realize that, yes, it may take more planning. And like, again, we were talking about time and, you know, mornings are hard for me and evenings and early evenings. But, you know, I can take some of Neurontin and a couple of things that won't make me sleepy, but will tamp down the pain. And it is so worth it just to, I don't know, just to have that bonding of just skin to skin. And even if it's not like, you know, full boning, just having, you know, just like I love your erotic massage course that you have on your site. I think I downloaded that, so I'm definitely going to be taking a couple pages out of your notebook, Chris. And but I think it's also, maybe, do you think it's fear too? Like, oh, I'm ashamed that our bodies are changing. I've thickened. And you can criticize our bodies, and the thing is, we should really feel like we're pretty badass. That if you can live with chronic pain and still like make sure that you will not acquiesce your sex life, like it's still so important. And I think, you know, I've lost my fertility through the treatments that I had, and I then had to have a hysterectomy. So, like, I never felt my femininity was in any way diminished, but I think maybe learning to be brave with chronic illness is awakening a sense for me to be braver in my sex life. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm going to use this, talking about this with you, as a motivation, because, you know, I feel like everywhere, every day I have a teacher, and today you've really been my teacher.
Oh, well, I love being in this conversation because, you know, since I've been living with illness and pain, I've been talking to a lot of people about it. And I think a lot of people do have this feeling of being broken. And I just had this talk with my partner because I kept referring to myself as a broken toy. Aww. And she at one point just burst out into tears. And what I realized, what I meant by it, was that I do feel broken, but still loved. And that I'm not trash. Like, some toys get broken and they just end up in the trash. And other toys get broken and they become the most precious toy in the room. And it's really been this process for me about learning how to be loved from this place and not mm-hmm. feel like a burden, not feel like I should be ashamed of where my body's at, but fully embracing it and seeing what it's capable of now.
Chris, had you just watched Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer when you thought of the, you know,
the land of broken toys?
Yeah, it's like, why am I such a misfit? Yeah. It was the elf who wanted to be the dentist.
Right. I forgot about
that. Have you just watched that?
No.
Okay, you got to watch the negative self-talk there, Toots. Yeah, but one of the things when you were saying that, reminded me of the great Hemingway quote that said, "The world breaks everyone, and afterwards, we're strong at the broken places." There's the Japanese idea. I think it's called wabi-sabi. Uh-huh. Are you familiar with this? So wabi-sabi is like there is beauty in brokenness. And so wabi-sabi pottery is it'll be like a beautiful platter. And then the artist will break it and then mend it either by weaving gold or metal or another element. And that there is beauty in imperfection. And I think one of the great things of being of age and maybe of acceptance, you know, living with an illness is that it is a great relief. I have no expectation of perfection.
Right.
And I live in New York City, and I am around a lot of yoga, like my girlfriends are this tribe of yoga moms, and you know they're all going to boot camp. And I'm like, when are you shipping out? Like, are you doing a naked calendar? I don't know about one of my girlfriends has exercised to the point that her arms look like a wheelchair athlete. Like she just has like these. Like absolutely, like the buffest body, and like, or they're like, oh, I've got to get my like pedicure. Like it's the dead of winter, and I just figure like as women, like I was taking inventory, and I was thinking from the tips of the roots of our hair down to the bottom of our feet, like it just seems so mean to expect perfection when that's not in the cards. But the fact that, you know, we're like dyeing your hair and then poking military grade chemical weapons in your forehead and like the eyelash extensions and just all this burden of, and I think it's, you know, if it's, you know, you're doing it for yourself and because you love it, great. It just seems like, gosh, that seems like an enormous investment of time. Like, I would much rather like read a book and snuggle. Right. I would much rather. It's a much better use of my time.
Seek out the pleasures and the joy and the connection.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Mm. And the touch. And too, it's like not being able now, my medicine's working and, you know, I just said goodbye to my kid. And, you know, I hate when I have to, when I embrace my husband or my kid and I've got a grimace because there's a rictus of pain stuck on my face. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe timing is so important too. It's like when I can kind of get all the medications, prescriptions, like all in sync. Well, you know, it's funny. I think like timing is important. Like I just learned how we always set an alarm to get up in the morning. This week I was like, I'm going to set an alarm for when we should go to bed because my husband when, you know, we'll be watching hockey, I'll be reading and then we'll come to bed and just, you know, fall asleep.
Yeah.
And I was like, how about this? We set an alarm and that is the cue for us to stop our evening activity, like whatever we're doing. And a lot of times it's separate. And then, like, meet in the bedroom and have that time together of being together, being important, and focusing. And so I've realized chronic sex just sounds negative, but maybe compassionate. Well, compassion means suffering together. And when you're having sex, that's the opposite of suffering. I don't know. Maybe we've got to work on this, finding a descriptor for the idea of just making time for sensuality. And, you know, I've lost my sense of smell. My sense of touch in my hands and my feet, and other places are, it's allodynia where it's painful to touch, and then other with neuropathy. It feels like I've got like two clunky cell phones strapped to my feet, and it's kind of like buzzing, and my hands are buzzy. But I think when you take the time to just focus on maybe what is possible, and my vision's okay, and you can feel more, not only just with your hands, it's skin to skin, and it's nice maybe to take into account, you're inspiring me, like all the senses that, and even senses that I have lost, to remember that they're not lost on my partner too,
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned pain mapping, mm-hmm. and then the flip side of that is pleasure mapping, whether it be physical sensations or dirty talk, mm-hmm. or kind of going into a fantasy together. Like, how can you just make that connection and get that oxytocin going between you just to feel that bond too? Some of the most mm-hmm. delicious parts of sex aren't contingent on any one part of our body. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. When writing this book, I was, I studied to be a hospice chaplain and how important touch is in chaplaincy work, and especially in hospice work, and learning about the oxytocin, the bonding hormone, and it's funny, like, when I was explaining over dinner one night about, oxytocin, and then sometimes my kid will come in to me, like, if he's like, I got a big test, I think I need a hit of oxytocin.
Yes.
And then he'll come and give me a big hug. And oh. I love that. Like, it's almost like I am the dispenser of it.
Yes.
And that's so great. Yeah. And, you're so wise too about, like, something I haven't even considered was, like, yeah, like dirty talk. Yes. I mean, hey, my ears are still working. My mind's still working. And, like, bring that in. Like, I feel like after, when you've, like, spat in death's eye, after, and you're surviving with diabetes, cancer, sarcoidosis, MS, any Parkinson's, any numerous chronic illness, like, you're such a badass that take that badass spirit that gets you out of bed every day and faces the world, take that and bring it right back to bed.
Mm-hmm.
But use that ferocity that we need, in order to be a teacher, host a podcast, as a writer, use that intention and that spirit that gets you out of your house, and then bring it right back and really focus. I think intention is so important.
Indeed. Karen Duffy, thank you so much for this conversation.
You are a wise woman, Miss Thank you so much, Chris. It was really a delight to speak with you. And thank you so much, and I wish you all the best.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that conversation and got as much out of it as I did. You can find the book Backbone and her first book, Model Patient, on Amazon or wherever books are sold, and they are definitely worth checking out or gifting to people that you know who are dealing with chronic pain or chronic illness. It's a lovely gift because it talks not only about the hardship of living with these conditions, but the hopefulness and the unexpected gifts and humor and generosity that chronic illness can bring into our life. And we will have these books and other resources linked up on the show notes page for this episode at pleasuremechanics.com, where you will also find our complete podcast archive, our free online course, The Erotic Essentials, and our erotic mastery courses, so you can master skills like couples massage, foreplay, or other sexual skills to guide you into your next erotic adventure. Use the code SPEAKINGOFSEX for 20% off the online course of your choice. I'm Chris from PleasureMechanics.com, wishing you a lifetime of pleasure. Cheers.